actually get some one or some of them.
Okay, so step two tonight is Steve Gribble from UW talking about spyware.
Thank you.
Great. Just to do a little sound check. Can somebody at San Diego confirm they can hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Great. Let's get going. So I'm Steve. I'm an associate professor here, and I'm going to follow up kind of nicely on stuff that was just talked about beforehand. I'm going to focus on the spyware problem and tell you about some of the spyware measurement studies that we've been doing here at UW, as well as give you sort of a little bit of background on spyware in general. And the way that I'd like to lead off is by telling you sort of an example that happened about a year and a half ago now. So the story starts with sort of a goofy website out there on the web called Kings of Chaos, which is a benign website dedicated to some online game that people will talk about through the website. So it was a friendly community that was trying to do good and service its customers. But in order to make a buck or two, in order to keep the service going, it basically contracted with an ad network to display banner ads on its site. So as a result, it gave up some control of what content is being served through the site. So in particular, if you look at this picture, that banner ad there in the middle is being served by an ad network called adworldnetwork.com. And the way that this would work is the HTML that Kings of Chaos would serve to the web clients includes JavaScript that would do an inline include of some content from the AdWorld network itself. So this all seems fine and good, but something that ended up happening about a year and a half ago is the ad network asked Kings of Chaos to deliver to the client ended up looking like this. And if you know how to read HTML, you'd be very, very worried when you saw this ad. It's basically some JavaScript that's been obfuscated to make it a little bit hard to see what it is. But the punchline of this is this quote-unquote ad really didn't display anything. What it did is perform a drive-by download attack on the victim's browsers, exploit a vulnerability, bombard the user with pop-up ads. Through the exploited vulnerability, it would install some spyware, and that spyware would continue to bombard the user with pop-up ads. So this seemingly benign site ended up delivering sort of a nasty payload to people as a result of that. So what's really going on in this particular example is the quote-unquote advertiser, the person who paid the ad network to deliver the ad to Kings of Chaos, to the user, was somebody who got busted a couple of years beforehand for being a spammer. He was sort of one of the, I'm not going to mention people by name on this, but sort of one of the most flagrant spammers out there who had been driven out of business by litigation. And he turned to this as an alternate business model. So his goal here was basically to force users to see as many ads as possible that were served from his web server. And as a result of an affiliates program, something that you mentioned before, he would end up drawing revenue from this. And in fact, what he ended up doing apparently is earning several millions of dollars through this particular scam. So by purchasing ads for some amount of dollars, he would end up getting a higher return on his investment by showing a bunch of ads from this web server. So it's a little arbitrage game using these poor web clients as the victims in this big sort of shell program. And of course the question now is, why did he use spyware? He ended up installing spyware for a very simple reason, so that he could show the victims ads even when they weren't browsing the web and didn't have their web browser up and enabled. It's a way of getting sort of a beachhead on the victims' computers and using that to continually bombard them with ads. So that particular person has since been brought to suit by the Federal Trade Commission, and it's ongoing. My strong suspicion is this guy's going to get driven out of business, and the fruits of his labors are going to be taken back from him, just like the person who got the BMW repossessed. So this person eventually did get busted, which is how I know about it. But the takeaway lesson from all of this is that this is sort of reinforced by our earlier talk. Your personal computer has value not just to you, but to other people for all sorts of reason. And roughly the way to think about spyware is that it's software delivered onto your computer that tries to steal this value from you. And the two various flavors of spyware out there, the slightly less benign adware, it tries to steal your eyeballs. And the more malicious stuff tries to steal either sensitive data, like your credit card or your PC's resources, by turning it into something like a spam relay. The second takeaway lesson from this is, even if you trust the website that you're visiting, you probably shouldn't trust the content that you're getting through it, because often that website doesn't control all of the content that it's delivering you. So there's a lot of malicious data out there, and some of it's being funneled through trustworthy sources unwittingly. So it's getting a little bit sketchy in that sense. And the third message, which has been hammered home by now, is that the software that we're running, both our applications like browsers and our operating systems, are weak against this sort of a threat in a way that they've got vulnerabilities.
I have a really naive question, which is, are there sort of man-in-the-middle attacks for JavaScript? For example, the way Google places ads from its admin inventory on your website, you know, if I run the Schnauzer Dog website, I can collaborate with Google and JavaScript downloads ads from their inventory to display on my Schnauzer Dog website, for example.
Right.
Okay. Is there a way to intercept, for these guys to intercept that substitute content that you're aware of?
I don't see a straightforward way. The only way that I could imagine doing that is if the website allowed the attacker to upload some sort of code, like if it's a blog, then they might be able to do some sort of attack that way. But roughly the way that this website that I described worked is the fetching of the ad was done by the web browser. So the website, Kings of Chaos, actually never saw that ad itself. It would basically be delivering JavaScript to the web client to go talk to the ad network to fetch the ad. So in some sense, that malicious data never actually flowed through Kings of Chaos servers. So I think you'd basically have to either change the content on Kings of Chaos servers, or you'd have to change, somehow attack the browser directly in order to pull that off. Yeah.
Google Ads does the same thing. I mean, advertisers feed in the ad, and you could feed in something malicious, and clients directly request the ad from googleads.com. So the exact thing could happen, but I think Google should have some checks and balances on what is being fed in their ad network.
Right, and really, if you think about it, there's at least four parties involved here. There's a person who constructs the ad itself. There's the ad network that delivers it. There's the website that provides the hook to delivering the ad. And then there's the client software that actually fetches the ad and displays it. So I'm not quite sure where in that full pipeline you're thinking the man in the middle of the attack would fit. But clearly it's possible to exert control over some of those endpoints.
There has been a couple of instances of DNS hijacking to get the man in the middle.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
so
exactly. That seems good.
That's interesting. So the website the client thinks it's fetching from isn't the website it actually is. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So let's press onwards a little bit. So what I wanted to do is, first of all, talk in a general sense about spyware, give you some background on the kinds of spyware out there and the things that are going on. Then I want to sort of segue into a local UW measurement study that we've done on spyware, and then follow up with a few brief slides with takeaway impressions. So for the background, really what I want to do is try my stand at definitions. That's a losing game because there's no way to define some of these things. Talk about the general trends and impressions that people have and what's being done about spyware industrially and also legislatively. So as we all know, spyware is something that we all know when we see it, but none of us can probably define, like other sorts of things out there. You know it when you spot it. And the basic problem about it is technically there's no single hard line that I can draw between good behavior and bad behavior from a program. So if a certain piece of adware does something, I can find a benevolent piece of software that might also do exactly the same thing technically. So it's hard to find a very specific definition of what's good and what's bad. So generally what people have agreed is spyware is a software parasite that tends to display certain kinds of behavior, like collecting information of value and sending it to a third party without you knowing it, hijacking functions, resisting deinstallation, installing surreptitiously without the consent of the user, and so on and so forth. But generally the takeaway is spyware is software whose goal is to provide value not to you, right? Even though you're the person who ends up running it. Sorry, let me go back.
The things on that list have fall into two categories. The top two have to do with what the value of the spyware is to the spyware provider.
That's right.
The bottom two have to do with what you might be able to do about it.
That's right.
And have to stick with the bottom two. Forget the top two. Wouldn't that make it a lot easier?
Possibly, although if you have background processes like Windows Update that you don't want to expose to the users all the time, is that a surreptitious install?
Of course Windows Update isn't surreptitious. It asks you all the time, all over the place when you want to do it.
Some of the spyware asks you, but in a way that most people won't see it and will respond yes. So
then that doesn't count.
But it's still spyware.
Right, guys, that's...
Because it's trying to trick you as opposed to trying to make it as clear as possible to you.
Question from San Diego?
Yeah, so I'm curious. This seems like it potentially might be a useful avenue for defining, coming up with a legal definition of spyware for putting together legislation and so forth. is it a very useful definition from an operational standpoint for building defenses?
I don't think so.
Is it important for you to say this or not?
My sense is, technically, operationally, this isn't a useful way of approaching it because it'll have too many false positives. I think this is a very useful thing to do legislatively because you can sort of deduce intent with some sort of judicial objective decisions. So this isn't a way to write software to protect it, but this is a way to write laws that will protect consumers, is my sense.
I'm somewhat skeptical about that, actually, because it seems to me if you adopted the bottom two guys of the definitions and provided a large button that says take away all the things that satisfy those two definitions, legitimate stuff would change.
I think you're right, that if you provide a well-defined path for installing and removing software...
Then there wouldn't be false positives.
Perhaps. That's not the world we live in today. Maybe this is the world...
You could only expect to live in that world if you provided some selective pressure.
Fair enough. So if Windows of the future would provide a much narrower interface for installing software and remove a lot of the extensibility interfaces, it'd be a lot easier to distinguish between things that are using the loud channel or things
that are using... At least make it crystal clear to the user
right.
Where those things are.
Right. My hunch is today there's too many ways to add code to a system, so this isn't useful.
We're down to about 10,000.
Only 10,000. Yeah.
I doubt that will ever be possible because there are too many cases of services that people wish to install that include other services that provide value to other people. Like, for instance, there are a lot of people that will put on, like, Kazaa, and they want the services that Kazaa provides, but there are other things it puts on there as well. There's no way that Kazaa is ever going to distinguish those two.
Now, I think this is a useful discussion. I think you're right today. The question is whether long run people will be willing to give up some extensibility and the ease of adding new functions in order to get security and more robustness. In other words, for grandma, does all grandma care about is a web browser and email, and who cares about installing new software? In which case you might be able to lock down the machine and take some of this away.
Wait a minute. These last two things don't say you can't have extensibility. They say it has to be exposed.
Right.
Right.
That's completely different.
So that would mean that if Kazaa had any kind of functionality, it has to show you what it's doing. And you can't say, I would install tool X, Y, Z to take over your system and be like, you're installing Kazaa. That's what you get.
Then you have the option to say, no,
I don't want that.
Right.
Or even if you said yes, you have the option to say no tomorrow.
Right. Fair enough. I think a small maybe mistake or a way that I disagree with you is the more ways that you have to add features, the more extensibility hooks there are, the more programs that allow you to extend, the harder it is to unwind all of this stuff.
That's a problem for Microsoft.
That's a problem
for Microsoft. That shouldn't be a problem for the user.
I agree. Exactly. Let's keep going. So how does one get spyware? There's basically three ways today. You download a program that you want that has software you don't want piggybacked on it. So this is basically the model where people today can make money from free software is by bundling adware on top of it and then drawing money from an affiliates program. So for instance, if you download Kazaa, chances are you got somewhere between 2 and 7 adware programs along with it. The second way that you can get spyware is through something called a drive-by download. That was the example from Kings of Chaos. You visit a website, the website attacks a vulnerability in your browser or creates a misimpression on the user that causes them to install software, and suddenly you've got spyware. And the third way is basically the snowball effect. Once you've had spyware, quite often it downloads additional spyware over time, and pretty soon you're overrun.
Do you have any feel for where the bulk of this is coming in, or is it coming in relatively equally on these three channels?
My sense is a year ago it was almost entirely spyware piggybacked on executables.
And that's a really old technology.
It's a very old technology that people realized was immensely profitable a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And therefore it exploded. These days, I don't have a strong sense of which of the three is the biggest. My sense is piggybacked executables are starting to come down for reasons that I'll talk about later. But in general, the problem is still quite high. We've been dancing around what spyware is. Very quickly, I'll give you some examples of it. Cookies and web bugs, I don't really consider that spyware. It's more a privacy issue in general. Browser hijackers are usually extensions that plug into IE and do things like redirect where your search queries go. Adware pops up ads. Keyloggers log your keystrokes, hoping to catch passwords or credit cards. Dialers look for a modem attached to a phone line and try to dial an expensive toll number that somebody else makes money off of you. And then backdoors, trojans, or tricklers are spyware whose job is to download these other classes of spyware, roughly speaking. And if you take a look at an anti-spyware tool, you'll see that the number of different spyware programs right now is measured in somewhere in the order of thousands. is my sense. So there's some variety out there in principle. And what are the basic trends? So these you have to take with a strong grain of salt and very closely pay attention to the sources. So the first trend is, according to people who are in the interest of selling you services protecting yourself against spyware, they'll tell you that most people out there have spyware. Right? So in particular, they'll say 80% of internet-connected PCs are infected as of October 2004. I actually believe this number, but I think the goal of publishing this number is more alarmist to get you to purchase anti-spyware tools.
I think that frequently includes cookies.
This particular number doesn't.
Okay. But most of the high numbers, they're defining spyware to include cookies, which, of course, almost everybody has.
That's right. Everybody has cookies. This one is specifically looking for a software process that's running, as opposed to cookies. To give you a sneak preview of some of our own data, we basically took a look at the web to find out what data was available for people to access and found that about 1 in 8 executable files on the web that you could download and install had piggyback spyware. And we took a look at web pages out there, randomly selected. What does random mean? We'll get into that later. And found that about 1 in 1,000 web pages out there try to perform a drive-by download in order to install spyware. So these fractions are relatively high. Like, if you asked me 15 years ago to predict these, I wouldn't have believed this, right? But the most interesting trend is the lines between spyware and the other sorts of threats that we've been hearing about are blurring over time. In particular, a lot of spyware these days exists to deposit a keylogger or a bot or a spam relay on your computer, as well as doing the adware sorts of functions itself. In particular, this is a problem that we've been having here at UW. In order to measure this stuff, we install it and analyze it, and we've almost been shut down several times for unwittingly installing spam relays on our machines, even though we're only opening them up for a few tens of seconds in order to analyze them. It's enough of a problem that other people have noticed. Yeah. So what's going on in response to this? There's basically three sorts of industrial approaches to dealing with the spyware problem, generalizing and missing some details. Vending anti-spyware tools such as Microsoft Anti-Spyware or Adware Spyware Search and Destroy. Predominantly, these are signature-based, so they'll recognize known spyware, detect it, and maybe help you remove it. There's sort of an inside of the infrastructure approach where basically people figure out where the spyware lives out there on the web and blacklist the URLs so that you're blocked from fetching it in the first place. So something that folks here at UW tend not to know is a while back UW installed an active intrusion detection system called a tipping point product, which would block you from accessing certain websites out there. So as a result of that, we've seen a lot less spyware and certain other kinds of attacks flowing into UW internal machines. But they turned that one on without letting people know, just to see if anybody would notice and complain about it. And nobody complained about it, which is good news.
He recognizes things by DNS name, though, not by number, right?
Yes, unfortunately. So they're susceptible to DNS cache poisoning.
Yeah.
And the third sort of response is make the end user's environment a little bit more robust by introducing sandboxes. So an example of this is a product called Green Border, which uses BSD-like jails to isolate Outlook clients and web browsers inside of a separate sandbox from the rest of your host operating system, so that even if something bad happens to the sandbox, you haven't contaminated the rest of your system.
So I'm a little confused on this tipping point machine. Is that something that is sitting in the DNS or UW machines, or is that?
It's something that's sitting on the path of all packets flowing in between UW and the rest of the internet, peeking inside of them to spot things like you opening up a web page to a known spyware URL.
Well, let's say that a machine is infested and it points its DNS server, it points its DNS to a rogue DNS server somewhere. Does a tipping point machine do any good?
It depends on what rules it's using. If it's using DNS-based rules, maybe, maybe not.
Because the rogue DNS server is going to dump back, essentially, numeric addresses.
Right. So the way to think about this is a tipping point machine is by no means foolproof, but it catches a heck of a lot of crud.
Okay.
Right. So it helps a lot, but it doesn't solve, like almost any security solution. Okay. Legislatively, what's going on? There were sort of two rounds of things that happened. There were a bunch of states that led the charge on trying to define anti-spyware legislation. And recently, there's been a lot of federal pushes. The most recent one is something called the SPY Act, Securely Protect Yourself Against Computer Trespass, I think, is the acronym. As of about a month ago, it passed in the House and it's been received in the Senate, and we're waiting to hear if it goes through the Senate. But basically, the problem with legislation is exactly the technical problem of how do you define what's allowable and what's not allowable. So the way that the legislation has been approaching this is basically looking at examples of spyware for such flagrantly bad behavior that nobody will disagree that it's bad, and outlawing that. So they've got sort of a long laundry list of things that nobody in their right mind selling a reasonable, benign product would put inside of their product, like hijacking your browser search, or constantly, incessantly popping pop-up ads up and not giving you a way to deinstall that software. So they basically picked a laundry list of really, really bad things, including forcing people making software to ask the user before installing software that collects information about the user and sending it to somebody else. So information collection programs, according to the SPY Act, will require user consent in order to be legally installed. And that's going to have some implications for some software. And then the interesting part about it is, even though they had this long laundry list of incredibly bad things, a lot of companies still complained about it for fear of being caught up in the SPY Act unwittingly. So there's a very long list of exclusions to people who are given sort of, you know, get out of jail free cards for these particular things. Law enforcement is one. ISPs are another. You know, Comcast doesn't want to be in the business of worrying about what bytes it's delivering you. The one that really interests me is manufacturers and retailers providing third-party branded software. So Dell, in particular, doesn't want to be responsible for software that's installed on the machine when they deliver the machine to you, is a way to think about that. And the SPY Act's got really big teeth. For every provision that you violate, you could be fined up to $3 million. Right? So if you get caught, you're probably out of business.
I'm just curious, how does some of this legislation work internationally? So if I build spyware and I'm in Japan, but someone in the U.S. uses it and this act is in place, what happens to me if I'm caught? Or how does this all work internationally? Because
that's back to this wonderful mutual legal assistance treaty. And there are very few things that fall under that. What would happen is this would come in, would be against the SPY Act. Somewhere along the line, they would prove fraud, and then they would go try to go to Japan and get you extradited for fraud, which may or may not work, depending on the Japanese rulings and laws, etc.
But a way to think about this is, if you're a U.S.-operated business, then this will snare you.
Right, sure. Right?
And if money is flowing through U.S. banks, this will probably snare you too. But you're right that if you live in one of these countries like Chad, let's say, this might not be able to snare you,
or China,
unless it's one of these secondary infringements like fraud that they can nail you with. Okay, let's switch to the measurement study part of the talk. So this is work that I'm going to tell you about that's going to appear in a conference in February, done with Hank Levy, Tanya Bragan back there in the class, and also Alex Muschuk. So basically the idea here was, let's try to understand a little bit more about spyware in the hopes of learning enough to help us defend against the problem better. Because there's a bunch of unanswered questions out there that so far we don't have great data on, like how much spyware is actually out there on the web, where do people typically get it, how many different spyware variants are there out there, and is the spyware the good stuff like adware or the really, really bad stuff like keyloggers in practice? So what we basically did is crawl the web looking for content, pulled the content locally, and analyzed it locally. Now, the disclaimer about this is, if you were to try to understand the spyware problem, this is probably not the best way to measure it, because we're measuring what's on the web as opposed to what's on people's computers or what's being transferred to people's computers. So this is one particular perspective on the spyware problem. An ideal measurement study would be what's currently on people's computers, but that's a much harder study to do for the obvious reasons. So with that provision in mind, I'll get into this. Basically, there's two parts of the study that we did. We crawled the web looking for executables and analyzed them, and we crawled the web looking for drive-by download attacks and tried to understand those as well. And the way that we analyzed executables is, our local favorite hammer is virtual machines. So what we basically do is, for every executable that we find on the web, we clone a virtual machine in a known clean state, basically Windows with as few things running inside of Windows as possible, and then use some heuristics to automatically install that executable on the virtual machine. And then once we've done that, analyze the virtual machine to see what's changed, to see if anything bad's going on. And in particular, for this study, what we ended up doing is an anti-spyware tool sweep on the machine after installing the executable. And roughly, we can do this about one virtual machine boot install analysis per 90 seconds, multiplied by about multiple virtual machines per physical machine and multiple physical machines, and we can do several tens of thousands a day on our relatively modest 10-node cluster locally. For drive-by downloads, if you've seen the Microsoft Research HoneyMonkey work, this is fairly similar to that, in that what we ended up doing is building an automatic virtual browsing environment where we'd feed a URL to Internet Explorer running inside of a virtual machine and then look for bad things happening inside of that virtual machine once Internet Explorer has fetched the page. So basically, we define a set of triggers that if they fire, we take a closer look at that virtual machine. And triggers will be things like processes starting up that have no business starting up, or new files or DLLs being installed inside of a computer, or registry entries being tampered with that shouldn't be tampered with. And when one of these triggers fires, then again we run an expensive anti-spyware check on that virtual machine. So let's dive into the results and tell you what we found. We crawled for the executable file study about 32 million pages in 10,000 different web domains, downloaded about 26,000 executables, unique executables. So if we spotted two executables that were the same, that only counts once in this particular number. And out of that 26,000 executables, we found spyware in about 1/8 of them. If there's any good news in this, it's that most executables only installed one piece of spyware in your machine. Although we did end up seeing, you know, some fraction of them installing 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different pieces of spyware and so on. Now, an interesting number here that I'm going to come back to is we ended up only detecting 142 unique variants of spyware out of those 26,000 spyware-infested executables. So even though in principle these signature databases have thousands and thousands of spyware programs in them, in practice there's a much smaller set of spyware programs that we found out there on the web. And we'll come back to that.
So where did all those other signatures come from?
Things that maybe existed briefly that nobody's picked up and used.
Oh. That the signature guys found anyway.
Did the signature guys find anybody? Or things that people have now stopped using because the signature guys know about them and therefore it's no longer effective.
It seems like such a huge discrepancy between 142 and 10,000.
It's a huge
discrepancy. It can't mainly be that.
I can just tell you the data, right? So
do you believe that this 142 is an evolving set, that so given a month from now you will not have the same 142 but a new 142, which is basically asking, are they trying to avoid the spyware?
I think it is an evolving set, but I don't think it's evolving that quickly, actually. Okay. I'm hoping that we're going to have some data on this pretty soon.
Yeah, you should know this by February when you give the talk.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. No, it's exactly the right question. The next thing that we did is segment the websites that we fetch these executables from according to some sort of topic thing, some judgment that we did manually, and then ask the question, if you visited one of the sites in these classes, downloaded a program, what's the chance that you ended up getting infected with spyware? And you can see that it ranges pretty dramatically across different regions.
You sent Alex off to assess all these blacklisted websites.
Yeah, exactly. So
for music, you can do it by buying a Sony BMG CD, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That really blew my mind.
Yeah, you need to visit the web for that.
Looks like there's a reasonable chance that they're going to end up in big trouble for that.
Yeah. I hope so.
They richly deserve.
Yeah, I sure hope so. So the good news is we didn't find any executables with spyware in newspaper sites. The bad news is 15% of the executables in celebrity-oriented sites had spyware inside of them. So the message to take away from this is the bad guys are targeting the areas of the web that are popular and seeding that with the spyware in the hopes of ensnaring more victims. This bottom category is a list of websites that other people, security companies mostly, have flagged as being associated with spyware activity. And interestingly, it's higher than all the other categories, but in some sense the blacklists aren't working for two reasons. 70% of the blacklisted sites don't have spyware. And many sites that aren't blacklisted do have spyware. So in some sense, blacklists, they do catch more spyware than other categories, but they're not a complete solution on their own.
But What was the reason for the blacklisting, though? Just because evil things happen there?
Like at one point in time,
attacks and spyware and.
I think these were spyware-oriented blacklists rather than bad thing-oriented blacklists.
Okay.
So at some point in time, somebody made the declaration that this site is associated with spyware somehow.
And it may have cleaned itself up.
It might have cleaned itself up. It might have been a false accusation. All sorts of things. We might have missed it on their site. Right, there's all sorts of things that could have gone on. So the next question is, if you actually take a look at spyware and understand what spyware is prevalent out there, one of our favorite things to do here is to draw a popularity curve and say, aha, it's Zipf. Right? Zipf's law is basically a popularity distribution that says the nth most popular thing receives one over n to the alpha requests for some alpha. So it basically says popularity is exponential. There's a few things that are incredibly popular and a large tail of things that are unpopular. So if you take a look at this graph on the right, what it basically shows is for each spyware program that we detected, how many times did we detect it? And what you basically see is the top 20 or 30 spyware programs are responsible for almost all of the infections that are out there. Okay? So most of the action that's happening is clustered around a relatively small set of spyware programs. The other thing that we looked at is, of the offending websites, how many spyware programs did they try to push at you? And what you could see is a similar distribution where there are some websites that try to push all sorts of spyware-infested executables at you, but there's a long tail of websites that only have one or two.
What's the alpha?
I don't know off the top of my head. Looking at this, it's not one because it's not 1,000 to 1,000 on the curve. So if you actually ask which spyware programs themselves are responsible for most of the infections, it's the adware programs like WinU, 180 Solutions, and Ezula, the things that people can make money by giving to you. If you do the same analysis for drive-by downloads, what you end up finding is about 5% of the web pages that we examined mount drive-by download attacks. And there's two types of drive-by download attacks. Roughly think of it this way. If a security dialog box pops up and you click yes, then you're giving consent to do that drive-by download. If you click no, or if no dialog box pops up, then you didn't give consent. So those are the two classes of drive-by download attacks. And the ones that work without user consent might do it by exploiting a browser vulnerability. And again, you can see this sort of interesting effect where the spyware is clustering in certain areas of the web. The last piece of data that I'll throw at you before we get to the next part of the talk is, then we ask the question, there are all these different kinds of spyware programs out there, keyloggers, adware, and so on and so forth. Of the executables that we found and the drive-by download attacks that we noticed, what percentage of those had these various functions? And not too surprisingly, what you end up finding is most of the things that are installed are being installed to show you ads, or hijack your browser, which is an indirect way usually of showing you ads. Some of them, particularly the drive-by downloads, are Trojan downloaders that will fetch more adware. But the really nasty malicious stuff like the dialers and the keyloggers are quite rare to spot out there. So in some sense, the nature of the threat, at least at the time that this crawl was done, is that most of the spyware that you're encountering on the web is the relatively more benign variety rather than the criminal variety that are actually doing keylogging installs.
So what we have found is that most keyloggers are installed by a downloader. So you would find the downloader and then the owner of the bot then installs the keystroke block.
So we did let that downloader simmer for a while and download some stuff and included that in the kind of spyware that you ended up getting. So this does include at least a few minutes worth of allowing the downloader to do some downloads. So some of it's included in there, but maybe we didn't let it simmer long enough.
Let it sit.
Question from San Diego.
Bots don't show up in this list only because we didn't analyze them.
Okay.
Not because they're not there. Is there a question?
Yeah, Steve. There's a class of spyware that I'm wondering if you've encountered that probably wouldn't show up in this study, and that is when it is the actual spyware is not in the thing that you download. So the most common way that this occurs is I distribute a movie via BitTorrent, and I encode it with a slightly one-off version of MPEG. It's not really MPEG, and Microsoft has this great feature where you can say you need to download the license along with the decoder for this before you can actually decode it. And so the object of your desire you've downloaded has no malicious content at all, but it forces you through the route of media player to then download a piece of content if you actually want to watch the thing.
Yeah, that's out there. This particular study wouldn't have caught it because we weren't crawling looking for media content that would trigger, you know, player installs. That's out there. Something that we have started to notice is a two-phase spyware installation where the thing that gets installed simply asks for permission or sometime later goes off and actually fetches the spyware so that the thing that gets installed will bypass the anti-spyware signature. Right, the beachhead will make it past the anti-spyware tool and then it will fetch it directly from that point on. So that I've started to notice as well, which is of a similar flavor. Okay, so let's wrap up this part of the talk and get on to the next one. The summary is there's plenty of spyware out there. It targets specific content. Most of it's annoying, but some fraction of it poses a pretty big risk. And most of the spyware variants that you encounter in practice are, there's very few of them, and even though there's this long tail, chances are you're going to be exposed to a relatively small number of spyware variants in practice. So let's get on to just a couple of slides on peer opinion. Starting with my view on the problem, for the past couple of years, I think we've all been inundated with the sky is falling sorts of media stories about the spyware problem. And I don't think that the problem's quite as severe as the media is making out. Or at least it's not going to be as severe in the near future. Because if you think about it, there's really sort of two classes of spyware that are out there. The ones where people or businesses of morally questionable judgment are out there trying to make a quick buck. So they're taking basically advantage of the fact that, at least right now, there's a blurry legal status about what you can and can't do with software. And they're taking advantage of that to install software that will, through affiliates programs, make them some money. And the nature of these people is basically they'll take off-the-shelf adware and install it on your computer. Maybe they'll tweak it a little bit, reconfigure it, but they'll very rarely engineer new code in order to pull off the sort of a scam. So their goal is basically take something with minimal effort and get it out there as far as wide as possible and do the sort of harvesting that you were talking about. And today, my impression is most of the spyware problem, that 80% of people have spyware, they have this kind of spyware. Now, there's another class of spyware, which is sort of the more hardened, determined criminal who's, you know, a fisher or a farmer looking for credit card numbers or a keylogger for corporate espionage. And they might actually be willing to engineer some boutique software in order to pull this off. So maybe the tail is associated with these determined criminals and the head of the popularity curve is associated with the chucksters. So if you believe that story, and this is pure opinion, what I basically think is going to happen is the legislation, when it passes, will take away a lot of the incentive for people to pull this off because it's no longer going to be legally blurry. It's going to be obvious that the things that they're doing are illegal, and they'll get nailed for doing it, and it's starting to happen. So the companies that want to remain in business and the individuals that want to remain legit will follow the rules as mandated by legislation. And basically, it's making it clear who the criminals are and who the shucksters are by de-teething the shucksters in some sense. And in some sense, for those people who are still willing to gamble for the legislation, who want to make a quick buck, the anti-spyware tools will take care of the rest. Because largely what you're doing with the anti-spyware tools is paying for the most recent top 30 signatures. And if you've got your spyware tool installed and it's updating the signatures, it'll catch most of the stuff that you're exposed to. So if I'm right about this, I predict that as anti-spyware gets rolled out in more and more Windows platforms, we're going to see that 80% number shrink substantially to a much lower number. And the news stories will lessen, and all of the people who are getting venture capital money to build anti-spyware tools will be in a bit of a jam as a result. So as for the criminals, I think we're a lot less prepared for this threat for a bunch of reasons. Again, mostly opinion. Regular users don't have a strong model of what's safe to do and what's risky to do. And even if they do, they don't have the good tools to cope with these sorts of threats. And corollary of this, or a way of seeing this, is right now operating systems are basically one trust domain that if code penetrates that, you lose. There's basically no firewall between stuff that faces the internet that's untrustworthy and your internal stuff that you actually care about. So if you care about these two sorts of things, maybe all we really need are some better street smarts mechanisms in operating systems or our applications. Help users avoid the sketchy parts of the web, and help users keep their valuables locked up a little tighter and safer. I don't know if you're going to talk about your red green stuff. Okay, you are. So we'll hear one way of doing this from Butler. And I think that's really all I wanted to say.
Questions?
Yeah.
It's possible I missed this in the talk, but how did you select a random web pages in your study?
Oh, there's no good definition of random. So what we ended up doing is harvesting search queries from search terms. Search terms from search engines who are willing to show you a rolling list of popular search queries. Use those to find a set of seed pages, and then randomly walked about 12 hyperlinks away from those until we ended up in some spot in the web. We call that a random web page. There's no good definition of random, unfortunately.
If you have time, it would be nice to look for the bots as well.
That's a good idea.
What we've seen is a shift. A lot of the, particularly your true criminal activity, is moving away from the sort of pedestrian 147 bots and moving to very specific bot-based code.
I think that's probably right, yeah.
Any questions from the south? Or further south?
Away.
Okay, so let's do a context switch here without a break and shift over to Butler. Steve, thank you.